For those of you downstairs, you don't know why we haven't started yet. We're still waiting for a few people to come in. So I'll start by welcoming you to a very warm old theatre. I have asked for the temperature to be lowered a bit, so be prepared to get very cold in about 45 minutes time. Anyway, if you can bear the heat, we have an excellent speaker for you this evening. I would like to begin by welcoming Branko Milanović. He's senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, lead economist in the World Bank Research Department, the unit dealing with poverty, income distribution, and household surveys, and adjunct professor at the School for Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Washington. He took his PhD in economics in 1987 at Belgrade University with a dissertation on income inequality in Yugoslavia. And I suppose your interests have been shaped ever since then in a fairly steady way. He's written several major books. I shall just mention four. His publications include Income and Influence, Social Policy in Emerging Market Economies, Poverty and Social Assistance in Transition Countries, Income Inequality and Poverty During the Transition from Planned to Market Economy, and in June forthcoming, Worlds Apart, Measuring International and Global Inequality. When I was thinking about all these titles earlier, I could say, well, he's clearly not a novelist, but these titles are very descriptive and mark out his expertise, which has developed in a cumulative and systematic way for now over 20 years. He writes on methodology and the empirics of inequality, on poverty and social policy in the transition economies, and he will talk today about his third major interest, globalization and inequality. He has sometimes been referred to here in the UK as the new Stiglitz, Stiglitz for the next generation, and you can begin to see why as one sets out his interests and so on. Although, of course, as we've agreed, there's a lot of life left, I'm glad to say, in the old Stiglitz as well. Branko will lecture this evening on global inequality from the Second World War to today. It's the fifth Miliband lecture in the series on inequalities, re-looking at inequalities. We started in September and we shall continue right the way through to the end of the summer term. Please join me in giving him a very warm LSE welcome.
Well, David, thank you very much. I'm extremely pleased, delighted, I'm quite honored also to be here. It is always a pleasure to come to London, and it's especially a pleasure to be at LSE. When David introduced my work, as you can see, actually, it followed some kind of a natural progression from one country, which, of course, unfortunately, in the meantime, disappeared, to a whole region, which was Eastern Europe, and now I've moved for several last years to global issues in the world. So I just sort of am sometimes fearful to think what might be the next coming. As I said, I'm very happy to be here. Let me see if it will work. Oh, it starts from the... and I'm particularly pleased to be a speaker in the Ralph Miliband Lectures of Inequality. Let me start with something which really doesn't have to do much with global inequality, but I would like to say a few words of homage to Ralph Miliband and just to give a small personal recollection. I read his book, The State in a Capitalist Society, in the mid-70s. And of course, I read it under very different circumstances under which Ralph wrote the book, because as you know, it deals with the role of the state in a capitalist society, with whether the state is an autonomous actor or not. I read it in the former Yugoslavia, where we faced a little bit different issues. On the one hand, you had positive things, which were, some of you might have read about that. You had policy of non-alignment, which I think was a good one. You had labor management. You had open borders. But on the other hand, you did have a sort of a party dictatorship through the state. So the book, of course, had some resonance and, of course, some interest for me then, although it described a reality which was somewhat different from the one that I faced. You see here a little of the sort of basically the prospectus of my talk today, but as I said, I would like also when I was invited to give this talk, I went and got Miliband's book. I found it, I must say, more easily on the UK Amazon than on the US Amazon.com. And then I went and reread some parts, and I thought it's a testimony to the quality of the author, and also maybe a testimony to the fact that the world has changed less than what we are inclined to believe sometimes, that there are some sentences, some issues that resonate still as much today as they resonated in the late 60s when the book was written. So you can, of course, read it here. One statement is on governments of the left, that very often when they come to power under conditions of great financial and social difficulty and crisis, which, of course, they have feared to see greatly aggravated by the suspicion and hostility of the business community. Consequently, their policies are not as left-wing as you might have expected. And, of course, when you read today about the position situations of Chavez or Lula, clearly you can see that this statement might apply. Let me give you another one, which I think particularly now applies to the United States, and where Miliband is quoting Wright Mills, with what he called that many civilians actually accept or basically take over and what is called the military definition of reality. And indeed, and unfortunately, I think that in many cases it is still very much true. So after these few quotes, let me move to the real topic of my today's lecture. I hope to keep it within the normal bounds, and I hope also that to make it relatively entertaining and somewhat towards the end, I will try to make it also a little bit controversial. But before we come to that maybe interesting part, we have to go through some relatively boring part which has lots of graphs and numbers behind them. So let me first start with some definitions that, of course, maybe people don't like, but we have to go through them. And distinguish between international and global inequality. As you can see, that there is a little bit of a terminological confusion. And we need to clarify that. We need to make sure that when we speak of international inequality, it is inequality between nations and mean incomes of these nations. And I'll come to that in a moment. And when we speak of global inequality, it is inequality between individuals in the world, regardless of what their nation is. Regardless where they live. In other words, you treat the entire world as if it were one country. So you're really interested in inequalities between individuals. Now, there is no dispute about the fact that global inequality is extremely high, but there is a dispute about the trends, whether that inequality is going up or is going down, and how important is the change. And finally, what most people are excited about, and where most of the dispute is what does it mean? Is it actually a judgment on globalization or not? In other words, can we draw, assuming that we know what the data are, can we draw the conclusions, can we draw a sort of causal link between the two? So now let me start with, as I said, I promise there will be not too many graphs which have so many words in them. There will be more pictures. But let me start with these definitions, that what I call concept one, concept two, and concept three inequality. The concept one, as I already alluded to, is the unweighted international inequality. As you can see, I even started writing that with a dash to sort of highlight the fact that when we say the word international, we really mean that it's something between nations. And consequently, when we speak of concept one inequality, it is inequality between mean incomes in different nations. It is a statement like the mean income in the United States is higher than the mean income in Pakistan. This is really what we are concerned there. And as you can read, actually, I'm not going to repeat all the slides, but the source of the data there is essentially national accounts. You take GDIs, or what was called GDP, still in my book it is called GDP, of the countries, and then you compare them. Obviously, you ignore within country distribution because you just have one representative individual from each country. Now, the concept two inequality is still the same in the sense that there is still representative income of the country, which is GDP per capita, but here the population size matters. So China would, of course, account for 20% of the world population, and, of course, small countries would account for much less. Consequently, if you calculate inequality of concept two, China's role, the role of China, would be very important. If concept one, it is like the UN General Assembly. Every ambassador, if you will have the income of his own country, and there will be 150 ambassadors, and that's all. Now, in the concept two, you will have, strictly speaking, 6 billion ambassadors, if you will, but all the ambassadors, quote unquote, from China will have the mean income of China. All ambassadors from India will have mean income of India, and so forth. But remember, one thing still is true in concept two, that you still don't include differences in incomes within each nation. So it is still international inequality. And the third one is one that I already explained, which is actually true, what they call true, quote unquote, world inequality or global inequality. This is, of course, inequality between individuals. And here, obviously, you have within the inequality within nations included there. But one major issue differentiates this concept one and two and concept three. And this will come to plague us a little bit later. And this is the problem that you're moving from between concept two and three to an entirely different source of data. And this is the household surveys. Because in order to have information about inequality within any country, you need to have a household survey for that country. Whereas for the concept one and two, you just need to have an average, and that average could be either GDP per capita or it could be the mean income of that nation from household surveys, but you don't need household surveys in those cases. So this, there will be some discrepancy between the household survey data and national accounts data, but we'll talk about that more. So now let me give you like a two-minute introduction simply on the historical perspective of how these two concepts have moved, because for the concept three, we really don't know how it has moved historically simply because we don't have data. Because concept three, as you have seen, depends crucially on the existence of household surveys. So let's look at the concept one inequality in historical perspective, where I use Madison's most recent data, and then plot Gini coefficient or a tail index of inequality of all the countries that are in the sample. Now, as you can see, it is actually generally on an upward trend from 1820 up to today, which means that differences between mean countries' income are increasing. Now, it is also true that the sample size has gone up because originally in Madison's data you have something like 35 or 40 countries. Then the number of countries expands to 50 or 60 or 80. Today you have more than 150 nations in the sample. So part of that increase is due to also to the fact that you have more countries included there. But part is real. Actually, if you just also focus on the countries that where the data exists, you still find this. And of course, then you can very broadly say, okay, to what different type of regimes do these changes correspond to? And of course, very roughly, as you can see here, I have indicated, you know, different global regimes which correlate or are associated with changes in concept one inequality. But one thing to remember is that it has been going up, and also that over the last 20 years, as we will see in more detail, it has continued its upward trend. Now, the situation is different with concept two inequality, because here I use the same GDP per capita data from Madison, same countries, but here they are weighted by population. And basically, since Madison's data include now both China and India, and we'll have a discussion on how Chinese data, how reliable they are, but accept them to be reliable for the moment, then you actually can calculate concept two inequality, because two measures that you need, two variables that you need, are GDP per capita and population. Now, as you can see here, the trend from 1850 is the first year, I believe, here, to about 1950, which is actually a peak, it is a clear upwardly rising trend. You have some, of course, You have some changes along the trend, but it's still on the rise. And then basically from the mid-1950s to today, in a historical perspective, you have this concept of inequality being about stable. And if you, some of you might have read, for instance, a paper by Morrison and Bourguignon, which actually deals with global with inequality between individuals using medicines data as well, this is essentially the picture which they find in their paper as well. Now, you can see this is a very high Gini coefficient of 50, and if you look at this data, really there is not much of a change in the last half a century. Now, let us move from this very brief historical sketch to what is inequality today. And here it is, I used one famous politician for the leader for the quote of my graph. And here is really the essential story. Where actually, and the essence, the key of the dispute. You see this world unweighted or international unweighted inequality, which is essentially going up, and particularly notice that it's going up over the last 20 years. And we will see that really what I think watershed years were 78 to 1980. So this upward increase is actually, it is the last segment there, it's from 78 to today. So it keeps on increasing. Now, the concept 2 inequality charts a very different course, and you can see there a decline of concept 2 inequality. These are actually more detailed data than medicines. And you see also that there is a sharp decline starting around 1980. And that decline is driven by the fact that China has grown very fast. And as China was very poor and had lots of people, as these people become richer, overall inequality in the world tends to go down. But when you, of course, take China out, this concept two inequality, as you can see, is generally stable. So the bottom line is that we have a concept two inequality, which many authors really tend to treat as the global inequality, but which does not include inequality within nations at all. We see that that concept too has gone down, but it has gone down thanks to one country, and we'll see in a moment also thanks to one set of numbers from that country, and of course that country is China. Now, when you come to global inequality, and this is actually based on the calculations that I've done, is you have these three dots for 3 years, 88, 93, and 98. So as you can see, the three dots don't follow a pattern. They're actually, there is a first an increase, and then there is a smaller, lesser decline. They're based on household survey data. So there are two things which distinguish, well, one thing methodologically which distinguishes these three data points is that first you cannot really draw it for the past because you don't have household survey data. The second thing is that the source of data, as I said, is different because it is not based on national accounts. The third thing is that the gap between these two concepts, between global inequality and the blue line, which is the weighted international inequality, that gap is explained by within national inequalities. So once again, this last point, which I think is important, I have just to emphasize it. If you go from the blue line and want to reach my dot over there, the difference between the two is composed of within national inequalities. Now, telling a little bit the story ahead, but just to give you an idea of what is coming, is basically when we speak of global inequality, we would have to deal with two important potent forces which have happened over the last 20 years. One is the rise of China and India, which being populous nations and having started very poor, are going to push world inequality down. And this is this blue line. On the other hand, increased inequality within most of major nations, United States, China, India, Russia, and so forth, will tend to increase global inequality by making the dots stand much higher from the blue line. In other words, there will be these two forces which would basically determine what happens to global inequality. And one of them is reducing global inequality, another is increasing it. And because they are moving in such complicated fashion, and because people sometimes don't want really to study things in detail, they are actually prone to make, you know, statements which are maybe too too, how should I say, radical or too broad. Now, as I mentioned before, I will go very quickly over that, but I think that there was a discontinuity in development trends around 1978-1980. I use quite a lot of three-volume book, which I think is excellent, by Baruch, an economic historian, and which describes, you know, basically economic history of the world in the last two centuries. And I think actually a number of authors has called that watershed years, and you can see I've listed some of the changes, radical changes, dramatic changes, which have occurred around that period. Now, what is interesting, that period also is a period where we see a break in trend in these different inequality concepts. The first thing that we know, it was from that date onward that within country inequalities, which is national inequalities, have tended to go up. And this, of course, was true, as we all know, in the UK, where actually, as you can see, historically, the inequality over the last 50 years has sort of charted a U-shaped curve, going down up to the mid-60s or early 70s, and then sharply going up. But it's also true for the United States, where inequality at the turn of the century is back at the level where it was in the 20s and the 30s. Then, secondly, inequality between countries have been on the rise, which is also another sort of a commonly, I think, realized fact, is that differences, among other reasons, because of the decline of Africa, further decline of Africa, the differences have been exacerbated between mean incomes of the rich nations and the poor nations. And then, as I already mentioned, then there was this contradictory trend due to the fact that China and India have started actually growing relatively fast, actually very fast, particularly in the case of China, since 1980. There is a little bit of a caveat, we'll come to that later, because of the data on China. And then finally, that inequality among people in the world, as I said before, is extremely high, and everybody agrees that it is between, let's suppose, Gini of 62 or 66, but as I said before, its direction of change is unclear. So essentially, I think we have this, the watershed years of 78-1980, which made changes in domestic policies, which drove the first factor up, then secondly created, not created, or you can say sort of helped the debt, caused the debt crisis, which then led into the differences between nations, and all of these, of course, elements produced the trends in inequality that we have seen in a minute before. And we'll see that in a minute again. So basically, this was the outcome. The middle-income countries declined, Latin America and Eastern Europe. China and India pulled ahead. Africa's position became even worse. Overall world growth rate went down. There is no change in debt rate is population-weighted because of the growth rate of India and China. And then basically Africanization of poverty, that essentially most of the African nations are now extremely poor, many of them actually poorer than they were in 1960. So this is why the difficulty of speaking about global inequality, as I said, stems from the very fact that the concept itself is hard. It's not hard to understand, but it's hard to actually to calculate it, to come to a sort of a number, because you need household surveys, and then you have also these contradictory movements, which led you at first to believe that there is one thing is going, maybe a stronger force, then the other one is offsetting that force. So this is why I think that there is, like as I said before, some confusion about that. Now let me just very briefly address one issue which is sometimes raised, and which says, why is inequality between countries important? And actually, many of you would recognize, basically, under just a different guise, they would recognize what is called the convergence debate or the convergence theory, that poor countries should tend to grow faster than rich countries, controlling for, if you want to better convergence, controlling for other factors, or sigma convergence is here, where it is actually not controlled for any factors, but it's unconditional convergence. And then why is it important now to look at that? First, because as we would expect from theory, we would expect actually convergence to take place. So if it is not taking place, why is not taking place? then some people would say, well, it is not taking place because some countries are not really globalizing. So only those countries that globalize and follow certain policies are converging. Well, that's not actually true because, on the other hand, policies, as we know even from indicators of policies which are very unambiguous, policies are becoming much more similar now, or actually are now much more similar than they were 30 or 40 years ago, or 20 years ago. So Danny Roderick asked this question, I think quite pertinently, if there is convergence of policy, why do we have divergence of outcomes? And there is really no good answer, in my opinion, yet. And of course, inequality between nations is important also for migration issues and so forth. And finally, one reason that I threw in there, I'm not, you know, necessarily convinced that it's always true, but there is a question if countries represent certain cultures, and then you think actually that these cultures have some value, intrinsic value in themselves, then probably you might actually not like the idea that there are huge differences in income or unbridgeable differences in income, because obviously nations that really decline are essentially these cultures are going to disappear because through time they would not be able obviously to compete. But you know, if you take more sort of a social Darwinist view of the world, you might actually say that does not really matter. Now, why concept two inequality matters? I think it actually basically, for my purposes, it does not have that much of a meaning except as the lower bound to concept three inequality. Because concept three inequality is really something that we want to have to have a good grasp of, but we oftentimes don't have the data, so we use concept two as a sort of a short shorthand to that. So I will now go very quickly over that part because maybe there will be some questions later and then we might have a chance to discuss it into greater detail. But I am going to recalculate concept two inequality, and the reason why I want to do that is the following. If one can sort of show that concept two inequality decline, in that concept two inequality, is much lower than it is generally thought, then global inequality could not have gone but up, because we know that the within inequality component has increased. Because we know, as I said before, that inequality in China, in the United States, in Russia, in large nations has gone up. So let's try to see if the data on concept two inequality are really firm or not. And then we can do that by breaking large countries into their states or rural-urban division. Because we know for China, for instance, in India, it's rural-urban division that really has, there is lots of inequality there. So if you take an aggregate number for China, you're really not showing the inequality which exists between rural and urban areas. So let us break it. Then let's look at the Chinese GDP numbers, because as you know, they're actually subject to intense debate, or scrutiny and then debate among different economists. And then let's include also countries that are generally not included, which is failed states, which are included in Madison's data but not in the other sources. So basically, this is my initial concept two decline, which is based on the World Bank numbers, and this is what I've used before, and it's also in my book and so forth. But then because of all this dispute, I said, okay, let's go and see if we can do better. And then if you, for instance, just to give you an idea how the sources among themselves don't agree, if you use PAN world tables, you have this graph, which this is the Gini coefficient, again, concept two inequality. But if you use Madison's data, where the number of countries is much larger, so that the failed states are included, 160 plus countries are included, then basically you don't have a decline in concept two. It's a very small decline in concept two. So you can see that actually the conclusion about the concept two decline depends very heavily on also on the data source that is being used. And of course, what is underlying that is also the data on China. Because Madison's data, which I just have here, have much lower growth rate for China than the official growth rate. There are differences of about 2 to 3 points growth between Madison and the official of World Bank data. I don't want to go into discussion of Chinese data. I think we will have more time to do that later to explain, if people are interested, to explain actually why there is such a big difference and why I think the Madison's data do make sense. But the bottom line is that if you do these recalculations, something which looked like an ambiguous decline of 3 Gini points turns out to have been about half of that amount. So essentially, you're able to change that to show that these numbers are really not as firm as they looked at first, because 3-point Gini decline is a fairly substantial decline, but then you come to something which is 1.5 point. And this is essentially the bottom line, that this unambiguous decline looks much less so. Now, as you said before, why does it really matter? Because we want to see what is the lower bound to this inequality between world citizens today. And as I said also before, if we can show that that lower bound itself is flat, then we definitely can claim that concept 3 inequality must have gone up. Now, if we can show that that lower bound is not flat, but it's slightly declining, then we really are in that area, which is gray area, where we have two almost equally strong forces, one which pushes global inequality down, another one which pushes it up. So now let us, this is the only formula. You don't need to know it to understand it. The only point is that the concept 2 and concept 3 can be linked by a mathematical formula decomposing the Gini coefficient. And that concept 2 really explains a big deal of concept 3 inequality. So that term, which is really big here, is also big in actual numbers. You know, so it explains 75% of overall inequality by essentially place where you live. So, and this is, of course, the graph which shows you the difference. It is in logarithmic terms. So concept 3 inequality, which takes now into account actual differences within nations, is going to be much more widely spread. There will be much greater inequality, because there you will have very poor people from poor countries, but obviously extremely poor people there. So they would be on the left-hand side. You would have also rich people, be it from the rich or poor countries, on the right-hand side. So what is the bottom line of concept 3? As I said before, you can essentially go back to the late 80s. You cannot go back before, because there were no data for the Soviet Union, for most of the African countries, and even China. Chinese data sort of kick in 1984. So if you go to 1988, take this as the benchmark year, and then use 5-year intervals, these are the numbers that you get, and these are the same numbers that were shown in these three dots. So you see that the global inequality went up from a Gini of 62, which is a very high number, which is actually a number higher than in any individual country. For instance, Brazil comes to the upper 50s level. And here South Africa is like upper 50s, low 60s. So this world inequality is higher than inequality that we would observe in South Africa. And if you take US dollars, because all these calculations were based, I forgot to mention that, are based on PPP numbers, purchasing power parity numbers, which tries to equalize incomes in poor and rich countries by taking into account that price level in poor countries is lower. But if you take only US dollars, you have an astounding inequality of a Gini of 80, which I think is definitely a number which has never been found in history, because it's an extremely, extremely high inequality, which of course nation states or smaller communities just cannot have. Such an inequality would be, I think, politically so destabilizing that we just don't see it. Now, here are some ratios which would intuitively give you an idea of how big the inequalities are. And then if you take the extreme position, like if you look at the US dollars, what it shows is that if you look in PPP dollars, the top 5% would receive 33% of total world income. So the top 5%, the top 5% would receive 1/3 of world income, and the bottom 5% would receive 0.2% of world income. Consequently, the ratio is 165:1. This is like you compare the top 5% to the bottom 5%. If you do the same calculation in terms of US dollars, obviously the ratio becomes 300:1, because the differences are exacerbated when you use actual US dollars rather than PPPs. And then similarly, you can see that the top 10% of people in the world get something like 50% of world income, consequently that 90% of the world also get another half. This is, I think, a sort of a useful number. It turned out very conveniently to be an easy number to remember. And this is essentially the same story, so I will skip this this graph, this slide. So now let us go back to the issue of reconciling the small decline in concept 2 inequality and the increase in concept 3. Now, one thing which actually happened is that, of course, the within-nation inequality went up. And this is what we see in these numbers. So there was like about one Gini point increase due to the inequality within nations, which went up during this period. But now we come to a very technical issue. So I will really also be brief here. I have several slides, but I will go very quickly, or maybe I'll skip them. But there is this technical issue that I alluded to very early on. It is the discrepancy between the movement in national accounts and movement in household survey data. And some people use GDP per capita from national accounts and then simply use decile, or actually quintile, data, 20%, from household surveys. Now, when they do that, what they actually do, they actually assign the difference which exists between national accounts and household surveys, which is really basically due to the rich people, and I'll explain why, they assign it to everybody equally. So I think one major methodological mistake, which is due to the mixing of national account and household survey data, is that it is not distribution neutral. In other words, if the difference between national accounts and household surveys is due to property incomes, to undistributed profits, to income, to imputed income from education or health, and if these sources are generally pro-rich, then when you apply GDP per capita to the distribution data derived from surveys, you really cannot just apply it in proportion as people do. So consequently, if you really want to mix these two sources, and of course people who work with household surveys like myself really don't like the mixing of these two sources, you really should then correct for inequality too. So as I said before, it is not distribution neutral. I don't want to go more into this now, but I just want to put that on the table maybe for later discussion, because India has become in that respect the cause célèbre of this discrepancy, because growth rate in India has been, according to household surveys, has been significantly lower than according to the national accounts. And for instance, Piketty and Banerjee in a recent paper showed that up to 40% of the discrepancy could be explained by the underreporting of high incomes. So essentially, you have two elements there. You have the static element, which is mentioned here, which I explained, that means that actually incomes that are badly captured in household surveys tend to be incomes received by rich people. And then you have a dynamic element that in a growing economy like India, and possibly in China, although we don't have studies like that for China, it could be that that bias is even greater than it is normally. Consequently, there are two arguments against a sort of a blind application of national accounts data to household surveys. I will skip this one. And now, basically, when we talk about global inequality substantively, we really have and want to go into the actual big players of the world's scene, if you will. We have really three big players there, and they are listed here: the rich countries of the West, urban incomes in China and India, and rural incomes in these two countries. Now, why are China and India separated? Because rural income gap in both countries, and indeed in most Asian nations, Indonesia, Thailand, for instance, the gap between rural and urban areas has been increasing. And as I said before, if you just assign mean income of that country, you are really disregarding what we know is a kind of an inequality that we can actually grasp, and that's an inequality between mean incomes in rural and urban areas. Now, if this mean income in urban China and India increase fast, they will catch up with rich countries. They're not catch up, but they will come closer to the incomes of the rich countries in the West. So that's good for world inequality. But if they increase very fast so that poor people in China and India in rural areas fall behind, then we have an opposite movement, because they stay low and add to global inequality. So the crucial thing is how these three forces work. In other words, if you have rural incomes in China and India growing substantially, as it was the case in the 1980s in China, for instance, when rural incomes grew faster than urban incomes, you have generally good, you can say on that account, good developments for world inequality. If you have increasing gaps between rural and urban areas in China and India, it is to some extent good because people from urban areas actually catch up with the rich world, but it could be also bad because rural areas, and they're substantial, I mean, in China it's 800 million people, are left behind. So let me then go to the distributions of countries, because this is now my part which I would actually come to some maybe policy implications of what I've seen done so far, because all of that was basically methodological issues and calculations. Now let us look here. I took France here because I had convenient data. This is what this graph shows is that this is French distribution, which each bottom is each ventile, which is 5% of people in France, ranked by their income. So the bottom 5% obviously are people with the lowest income in France. Now, in terms of world distribution of income, you will see that that bottom point here is at something which is like 72nd percentile of the world. What does it mean? That the poorest Frenchmen are richer than 72% of people in the world. And then, of course, you actually go higher and higher, and, of course, the top 5% of people in France, and more or less is true for all Western Europe, are really people who are at the top percentile of the world. Now, how does this compare with rural India? It compares it in such a way that basically if you do ventiles, you don't have the overlap between these two distributions, because you see that even the top 5% of people in rural India are poorer than the poorest 5% of people in France. And when I come in a moment to my sort of policy conclusions, I mean, one should remember that there are some countries distributional overlap. And this is important, because if you argue in favor of transfers between the rich world and the poor world, then really you, a priori, you would like actually to have transfers between the distributions that don't overlap, because the danger of a mistransfer, that you actually might have a transfer from a richer person to a poorer person, in those cases is quasi-zero, because the likelihood of such a regressive transfer is very small. And then simply to illustrate a few other countries, you know, here is you have Sri Lanka, which has what is called, you know, first order dominance, which means at every income, at every percentile level, it dominates rural India. Then you have Kazakhstan distribution, which I use as, for instance, proxy for the transition countries. And then there is a very interesting distribution here, which is Brazil. Now, what Brazil shows you, as you can see, is that basically Brazil is essentially like the world, because the world distribution would have been a straight line. Because if I take the world, it would actually go from the bottom to the top as a diagonal. And Brazil, the poorest people in Brazil are poorer than everybody else. And the rich people in Brazil are as rich as rich West Europeans or Americans. And now, that also is an important piece of information, because a priori, again, unless you have a good targeting mechanism, these are the countries where, a priori, you cannot be sure that income, if there is a transfer, is going to be transferred well. Because it could well be that actually somebody who is in the bottom decile in France or bottom quintile in France subsidizes income of somebody who is richer than he in Brazil. And I think lots of resentment and lots of this aid fatigue comes from the perception, sometimes true, sometimes maybe exaggerated, that essentially, you know, middle class in rich country transfers a portion of its money to rich people in poor countries. And if you look at you know, we can do this sort of graphs for many countries, you can see that it's not necessarily meaningless. Just one more here. It is the graph which shows you comparison between Africans and the rich world. So it's basically Africa versus Western Europe and United States. Now, the red line compares incomes at each percent ventile level. So the first number is 60, which says that the poorest 5% West Europeans are 60 times as rich as the poorest 5% of Africans. So for the poorest people, the ratio is tremendous, 60 to 1. But then that number goes down, and then you see that the very top 5% of West Europeans are only about four times as rich as the richest Africans. So you can see, of course, again, much greater inequality in many poor nations, which is, of course, displayed here. And the blue graph shows you the income of this top elite, African elite, versus European, West European ventiles. Now, you can see that actually it's not very clear, but you can sort of imagine that that top number is, the value is 8. That means that the African elite, the top 5%, on average have an income which is 8 times as high as poor West Europeans. And this is, I think, again, as I said before, this is where all this issue of aid comes from, is that you really don't want money to go into the pockets of people who might be like 5 times richer than, let's suppose, a taxpayer in a rich country. So let me just go and then move to the an issue of inequality transition.
Frankly, you've got about 10 minutes.
Yeah. 5 minutes, excellent. Ten minutes. That's even better. Inequality transition is the point made by Lucas and Glenn Fireball, who is actually author also in the book of World Inequality, which basically argues that global inequality has peaked and then we actually can expect a decline. It is based on what they view essentially as permanent effects of industrial revolution, essentially technological transfers spread from originally England, then to Western Europe, then Northern America, and so forth. So now they are in China and India, and consequently the whole world will tend to converge. But, of course, there are two, I think, problems with that view. The first one that I already mentioned is that policy convergence, which is implicit there, did not lead to income convergence, and we have 20 years of recent history to show that. The second thing is that that this is based on a rather static view of technological progress. In other words, surely industrial revolution happened, but after that there were many industrial revolutions, most recently the computer revolution. So consequently, you might actually have poor countries catching in some areas, but the rich countries may actually go, as the, for instance, endogenous growth theory suggests, might go actually faster, and they might actually accelerate. Consequently, you cannot just see the spreading of this technology as being a one-off event and it spreads. It's actually something which is permanently happening. And I'm relatively skeptical about that because, as I said, one of the points here, that downward slope in the concept two inequality really depends on the one set of on one country, which is China, and one specific set of numbers for that country, which may be, as we said before, questioned. So this is just a general sort of wrap up about we saw at the beginning the historical sort of a trend in concept one and concept two, and this is something which is a discussion about where it will go. But then the question is actually does this global inequality matter? And that's where my policy. Part with which you might not agree. You might agree with the calculation part and disagree with this one, or do the reverse, but the two things are really, I think, independent. And there are some arguments that global inequality really does not matter for the reasons that I have mentioned here. Is that actually it is too abstract, too vague, there is no government, there is nobody in charge of inequality. Now, it's not so much different from, and I think this is a crucial point, from the situation which existed in today's nation states before they became nation states. So long as you have a disparate groups of individuals living in cottages in small towns, villages, and there is no even sort of mental conception of a nation, then really inequality per se does not matter because there is no one to compare against. You might compare against people in your village, but you don't compare against against other people in the country. Once you have a concept of what makes a nation, then of course, once there is a government, somebody is in charge of that. What I think is happening is that actually, as we become more globalized, the concept of one world and global world would become much more acceptable, and consequently then poverty and inequality elsewhere would affect everybody, not equally, but would not be of zero importance, as we know that already now, to people elsewhere. So this is why I think actually that global inequality matters, not the least because globalization process by itself actually increases the awareness of these differences. So the process by itself, is crucial. And this is why we have here what is the correct utility function? It looks complicated, but it's not. It is simply the question is, do we really, in a correct utility function, have only our own income or our income with respect to somebody else? And if with globalization, that comparable income, or actually that the income of a person that we compare ourselves with is increasing because our reference point goes up, then clearly that could actually make us feel less satisfied with income that we have. And there I have two quotes, nice quotes, one from Ann Kruger, who says really basically the only thing which matters is your own income. And forget about everybody else's income. And, you know, people who actually think about other people's incomes are essentially full of envy, and they don't count. But then I have found a very old quote from Kuznets, 1954, that was much before the days of current globalization, which argues the opposite, which actually says it really what we are essentially social animals. We are, of course, concerned about our income because we have certain needs that we have to, you know, we need to eat, we need to clothe ourselves and so on. So we are concerned about being well off. But we are also concerned with other people, whether you call it fairness or comparison or envy, whatever, but we are not indifferent about other people's income. And this is where globalization comes in, because if it increases awareness of what other people are receiving, then your income, I suppose you're in a poor country and your income with which you were satisfied before may no longer seem satisfactory. Consequently, the process of globalization per se might influence the perception. And I think this is one of the important points, I believe, is that actually the process which is objective, if you will influence perception of people. And then what can we do? I will go, this is a slide I'll go very briefly because everybody knows that. It's a litany of the usual things that need to be done, including I have a quote from Stanley Fisher who says that the international trading system is biased against the poor countries, and there are many of things which we already know, removal of agricultural subsidies, change in WTO rules. But I wanted to do something much more controversial, so this is here in red letters, and this is the issue of global transfers. Now, why is it important? Because remember that graph with the different countries. Because if we really think of the world as a whole, I think we have to start moving towards something which would be very, very modest, global safety net. But we need some rules for that safety net. And these rules are, first, what I call the progressivity one condition, that they should flow from a rich country to a poor country. This is no big deal. Obviously, transfers already fulfilled that condition, that they flow from a rich country to a poor country. But then we need from these transfers to satisfy the same conditions that they satisfy at national level. They have to be globally progressive, as they are within the United Kingdom, for instance, in principle, nationally progressive. That means they have to go from a richer person to a poorer person. That's where my graphs with different nations come into handily, because you really don't want transfers, as we saw in that graph, to go from some middle-class Frenchman to somebody who is very rich in South Africa or Brazil. And then further, we have two more conditions, that these transfers should make national distributions better. In other words, you have this T and B, of course, the two distributions, the rich country's distribution on the right and the poor country on the left. Now, that transfer satisfies the axiom of globally progressive, because the guy in the rich country is a little bit better off than the recipient, B is the recipient, beneficiary, in the poor country. But look what they do to the national distributions. They make them worse, because what happens, you're taxing somebody who may be relatively poor in the United Kingdom, and then give money to somebody who is relatively well off in an African nation. But even if the difference between the two of them is progressive, that the poor Englishman is a little bit better off than the rich African, within nations, that particular transfer makes situation worse. So we don't want that. We want actually rich people in rich countries to be taxed in favor of poor people in poor countries, because then you have within nation distributions better. And this is simply the summary of these four roles: progressivity one, global progressivity, and national progressivities. And then finally, my final slide, that's sort of most controversial, particularly in its title, is what they called, for lack of better term, I might actually drop the second co-author here, the Tobin-Brezhnev approach. Now, the Tobin approach is one that you're quite familiar, which is taxation, whether it's financial flows or air traffic. But the key point is that for the first time, you would have a global authority with its own source of income. So you have a supranational authority. If you have a supranational authority, then you can view world as one. And in that case, you can sort of argue for the existence of a global safety net. But I think that global safety net should not be, and actually conceptually should not be, a safety net that would really have a relationship between states anymore, but relationship between the global authority and individuals in poor countries or poor people, wherever they are. In other words, what you don't want, again, the filter of state-to-state relationship, because we know that this is the filter which has not been very successful so far. If you have global issues, then you have global institutions, which that institution would be, presumably, that would handle the Tobin tax. But you have to circumvent nation states. And hence the second co-author, Brezhnev, as the author of Limited Sovereignty, essentially you have to disregard national borders. And even if the countries don't particularly like the targeting of particular groups in their countries, you should have actually a global power to do so in order to help the poor people. And then why does a change in approach, I think, desirable? Because we know that neither projects which were done in the 50s and the 60s have been successful, nor the structural adjustment. And finally, that's why, and this is my last sentence, is actually why I think that transfer of this purchasing power should be really money transfer, the same way that it is done in rich countries, where you basically give money to people who are unemployed or people who are social assistance. Here you would just do it at the global level. And where I got this idea from was more than 10 years ago when I observed the situation in Russia and the plight of Russian pensioners. Now, compare only the two situations. The current one, the then existing one, where Western money went to a basically corrupt government that stole that money and then bought, of course, good football teams. Or an alternative approach where that money would have been earmarked for pensioners. And not only earmarked, but when the global community would have used the rules for pension payments and the existence of the infrastructure to say, okay, we are paying pensions for September and October and November from this fund. Every pensioner, of course, will receive the money, and he would know or she would know that that money comes from us. I think it would be a much preferred situation. The Russian government might not have liked that, and that's why there is this limited sovereignty of national governments. But I think from the ethical and from the perspectives of transfers, the situation and perspective of pensioners, the situation would have been much better. So I will stop here, gone a little bit over my time.
Take questions in clusters of five, and perhaps this evening you might just give your name, your institutional affiliation, and then a short question. Let me start. Roving mics, should we start at the front?
Hello. Yeah, Bernard Casey from Cass Business School. Two very quick points. Do you recognize regions rather than world? And in other words, could the European Union, with its concern with social exclusion and poverty, play a kind of regional alternative to some world government? And secondly, Do you not see problems of moral hazard with world government, since if we distribute money to Russian pensioners, this might give an opportunity to the Russian government to do something else with its money?
Mike Joffe, Imperial College. Can I suggest another reason why these inequalities in purchasing power may be important, which I don't think you touched on, which is that people with increasing purchasing power come to determine, if that's not too strong a word, what is produced. For example, the World Bank has estimated that 80% of the world's agricultural land will be used to grow crops for meat in the year 2020, and that squeezes the land for the poor. Same thing applies to motor car and things like that. So there's actually physical reasons why inequality is important.
Hello, James Sproul. I'm a city economist. I noticed in one of your slides that you had Gini coefficient of between 64 and 66, which, as you rightly pointed out, was pretty high, and we're saying that at that level, you had 10% of the world's population earning about 50% of the total income. Just coincidentally, that happens to be about the same tax take in the UK, that 10% of the people pay about 54% of all of the income. So it would seem, on if you're going to equate tax take along with Gini, that you've got a very, very unequal distribution of the way in which you've taken taxes from that. Given that you're saying tax the rich people in rich countries, it seems that you've already reached the limit of possibly doing that.
Brendan Martin, Public World. Even if the idea of the global safety net were approved, would it not need very considerable institutional and organizational capacity at national and local level in order to be implemented?
Jaideep Gupta from the Institute of Development Studies of the University of Sussex. I have three quick, almost technical questions about concept three, inequality, since it is the most controversial of the concepts. You presented results using the Gini coefficient. I was wondering if you had calculated for the Thiel index. Secondly, in one of your papers, you mentioned that data for India and China is still on the group level, rather than the household survey. I was wondering if you could expand on that. And thirdly, essentially calculating the concept three requires comparing a 6 billion long vector. And you've made this comparison at the percentile level. And I was wondering if it was made at different levels, whether the rank reversals would have been given a different result.
I'll try to be brief, because I really wish actually to give people more opportunity to ask questions. On the European Union, a very good point. Really, I have not thought of regional implications. So whether a regional authority can substitute for global, I think it's possible. But really, I'm totally totally improvising. I haven't thought of that. On the moral hazard, yes, it is true. It is actually the problem which exists, as you know, it exists whenever there is a transfer. Particularly, it would exist here because you're transferring for something which, in principle, national governments should do. But, you know, I'm not sure that it is really... if you look at the Russian government, did not seem to have really bothered them very much that the pensioners did not receive. So to the extent that it does not really bother them, I think that the danger is less. Maybe there is, to some extent, that danger that actually you can have poor countries say, well, really, we don't care what happens to our poor people because they are really they really have to be helped by the rich world. But I don't really think that it is such a big danger. Secondly, I forgot to mention, because didn't have time, and you know, it is also that I'm not in favor of these transfers being a permanent transfers in the way that unemployment benefits or social assistance are here. I think that they should be one-shot transfers, And they will be simply given from time to time, depending on where the largest need in the world is. So if you happen to be, it's almost like getting food aid in some sense. Here it will be money aid. But if you happen to be in Ethiopia and you need it today, you will get it. But it doesn't mean that you're going to get it next year. And of course, I think it's better than food aid because, of course, food aid has its own problems that I think people know. Now, I totally agree that rich people, of course, determine by their incomes what is being produced. They determine also the very oftentimes, and going again back to Miliband's book, you know, they determine even what type of government one lives under. Now, on the taxation, yes, of course, if in Britain, okay, top 10% of taxpayers pay more than half of total taxes, that's because the tax rates are progressive. Consequently, the 10% of richest people in Britain probably have something like, you know, 35% of total income. But because tax rates are progressive and poor people don't pay them, they, of course, would pay more than half of total taxes. Now, whether it has really reached the limit, you know, we are not really talking here about major, additional money. Even in the calculations that you have seen for Tobin tax, these amounts are relatively modest when you compare them to the actual wealth which exists in the countries and also to the, you know, spending. If you look actually at the total amount of aid is 50 billion or so per year, and only the supplementary, for instance, spending on war Iraq was 80 billion. I mean, this is, we are not talking about, 500 billion of transfers. I'm sorry, that was, let me go for, I have to read my handwriting for question number four. The concept three, it is, on India and China, the data are still at the group level. For China, because you have the only way that you can access rural and urban data is at a group level. You don't have individual level data. And for India, you actually can have individual level data. But I've used the group data simply because of inertia. But I agree it should be, actually, India should be still kept rural and urban, but it can be divided much more precisely than what I have. Then there could be a rank reversal. That's a very good point. Actually, somebody pointed out, Bill Sutcliffe in a paper, I believe, that when I showed some curves about the first order preference and so forth, that actually there could be some rank reversal depending on how good your grid is. In other words, if you use ventiles, it is a rough grid. If you use like percentiles, your grid is much finer. So consequently, you might have some rank reversals there. That's why I actually also prefer to present it in terms of ventiles rather than deciles, because they are more precise. Now, let me go back to global safety net. Yes, if you don't mind.
I asked, even if the principle of such a global safety net were approved, the institutional and organizational capacity required at national and local levels would be so great that the problems that you're endeavoring to tackle might fail at implementation because of the correlation between the inequalities and the lack of organizational institutional capacity.
Yeah, excellent question. I agree with everything except the last part about the failure, because I think that this is actually a unique opportunity for, let's suppose that such an agency, because if there is a Tobin tax at one day, there will be somebody who has to administer that. That agency is not international, it is a global agency, essentially. And I think it's a unique opportunity for using NGOs and the knowledge that they have accumulated and working together. And rather than having these broad statements about everybody working together, here I think actually that you could do that. In other words, you have lots of knowledge accumulated in different Western or Northern NGOs and local NGOs that have worked under conditions of famine, civil strife, and so forth. Now, that can be used in this emergency, in this global safety net, or basically which is composed of purchasing power or money transfers. And I think actually that despite the fact that these problems are institutional problems are serious, I really believe that they're surmountable. And the example that I gave about pensioners, of course, I think shows them to be surmountable. Of course, you can say it's an easy one because it's much more difficult to target poor people, I suppose, in Uganda than pensioners in Russia. But I think with categorical targeting, whether it be regional, whether it be, for instance, children who go to school and who have single parents or so on, I think it is feasible. Last thing about other coefficients I forgot to answer. Yes, they are all there. So, you know, Gini is only one example.
Okay, let's take five more questions, please.
I have a relatively simple question, but just quick comment on what you were saying just now. A noble ideal, but I just thinking of a small country like Britain, all the lobbying and so on that has to go on to persuade those in charge of the money, let's put the money here and not there. And if you're looking all over the world, who is going to decide and who is going to do their best with corruption or persuasion or whatever to get the money in the right place, not the really poorest sitting in India who won't have a clue what's going on. My simplish question, how would you envisage, because I think we somehow got to do this, persuading the rich in the poor countries that they should prefer lessening the inequality within their own country to trying to lessen the inequality between their incomes and that of the average person in the West. For instance, poor world doctors and engineers, etc., can move to the West and much improve their own standard of living, both in their incomes and all the other things they don't have to pay for here and don't exist there, such as good roads, trains, hospitals, schools, museums, etc.
Branko, could you elaborate a bit more on your answer to the proposition, or rather to the question, what's wrong with the current level and projected increase in the current level of inequality in the world? In other words, if you were to talk to the G7 and other similarly powerful players, what sorts of arguments would you put to them as to why it would be in their interests to reduce the current level of world inequality, perhaps by the income transfers that you talked about? What is wrong with inequality?
Hi.
Okay, it's Hannah from Destin Development Studies student here at LSE. You make a compelling case for an essentially relative conception of poverty, and I'm curious whether you're aware of, and if so, what's your take on the relative costs and benefits of a competing, justice-respecting redistribution scheme, the universal basic income, which is an unconditional lump sum transfer, and it's not ambition nor endowment sensitive in the manner of your favored proposal of the universal transfer of purchasing power. Thanks.
Thank you. Hi, Benjamin Cohen, SOAS. I'm just wondering if your support for a global institution is backed up by the research department at the World Bank, and if so or not, whether that has any influence on the policy departments of the World Bank.
I disagree completely with your point that Western and Northern NGOs can help solve the administrative problem that guy brought up. I think they're politically charged and unaccountable, and people in developing countries don't always believe in them. Thanks.
That's five. Do you want to just be fairly brief in your answers? Because it'd be excellent to just take a few more.
I would be very. Okay, on the first one. It is true, actually. Can I conflate a question about the World Bank and this one? Because it's really sort of issue of institutions. clearly to give authority to people, whoever they are, to decide who is really most needy now, it's a huge, power. And obviously it can be subject to corruption, as we have seen, for instance, at the UN now. And however, I believe that such a, it's not different than, I mean, it's better than what is the current situation where you still have to make the decision, but you're making it between a state-to-state relationship. In other words, you're not really trying, even theoretically, to help the directly the poor. You're basically transferring amount of money to a government that might often be the, not the cause, but one of the contributors to people poverty. So I think it's an improvement compared to the situation today. Now, how can you persuade rich people in poor country that less inequality is good for them? It's really, it is difficult. You know, one of the implications of that graph with different countries was that also you can introduce possibly a measurement of inequality in the country in your decision about lending. In other words, you can say, well, countries that are definitely, they are very unequal, where you have people who are actually at the top who are very rich, should be somehow penalized. The problem with that is, of course, the problem of each sanction that you might actually penalize those who are really in need of that. I have no answer to that. Now, for the World Bank and the global institution, well, this is really something that, you know, obviously it's totally, you know, nothing to do with the World Bank policy. It's not, I'm not trying to reinvent the role of the World Bank, but I actually think that a very streamlined, there will be some change in that role, and a very streamlined institution like the World Bank could actually work with NGOs. So I would actually see the World Bank possibly in a much sort of more streamlined version doing this. Now, whether Western NGOs are good or bad, you know, I agree that they may be politically charged, but I don't think that it's actually, I would not probably take such a sort of a stern view that, that whatever they do is not really worthwhile. I think that there is lots of knowledge which has been accumulated simply because they've been working in these countries for a long time. And of course, local NGOs. But you know, local NGOs are subject to the same capture that northern NGOs are. So maybe there is an informational issue, but the capture issue is not different between the two. Unconditional transfers, of course, I agree. I mean, but I think actually that it seems to me it's more realistic to start with something which is much more modest, and I see my proposal as being more modest than a sort of a more maybe grandiose one of giving everybody more or less the same rights, because I think that's a little bit difficult. Now, Robert Waite's point, very well taken, maybe I'll have a chance to expound that later, but you know, it's also, I think the reason why I took a position against these two views of Firebaugh and Lucas, first, for the reasons that I explained, but also because I think they feed certain complacency. They say, well, yes, you know, if we just let things slide and go as they're going, we will have this U-turn of inequality. So it has been going up for two centuries, but now it's going to go down. So you really don't need to do anything. It will just go down on its own. And I'm in favor of a more, how should I say, activistic approach.
Two more questions.
You have to press it. Margaret Thomas, an economist who worked in the third world for 21 years. I'm interested in your view. When I started work in the third world, and I'm going back now to 1980, and the first country I worked in was Botswana. The countries were working very much then to five-year plans. And because of the demise of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc generally, planning in that way has faded. And I regret that in many ways because a lot of my work was in the health sector. And Botswana, for example, took enormous care about trying to invest with aid from the West in education and health. And all the countries I've worked in where there's been that move, I'm thinking of Brazil, I'm thinking of northern Pakistan, those investments have made a lot of difference to people's lives. They haven't been a direct transfer of money, but they have been a real investment in human capital. I'd welcome your comments.
the one at the back here, and then we'll go. Just hang on. Hang on a second. At the back, down here.
Yeah, I'd like your comments on type 3 concept of inequality. I mean, especially with regards to household surveys, in taking into account valuing women's work, and looking at the inequality between incomes of men and women, in terms of globally inequality.
Squeeze one more in.
Hi, Gabriel Moreno, Goldsmith. Those countries you call middle-class countries haven't been able to reduce their poverty. Countries such like Mexico, would you please tell us why and what do you recommend for these nations? And do you see the World Bank and the IMF ready to push policies in favor of economic growth that don't consist on reducing spending, swapping debt in more favorable conditions? And since you're known as a new Joseph Stiglitz, you may have something to say about that. Thank you.
Just a final reflection from me. I mean, a question that's put to me all the time. I mean, what isn't a fairly obvious question, really, about the political basis for your views? Where do you see a potential coalition emerging, if anywhere, to support this kind of an idea or program? Because on the face of it, it's hard to imagine where the politics for this kind of policy change will come from. Gordon Brown is trying very hard at the moment to persuade the G8 to take a number of economic and development initiatives in the current British leadership of the G8, and has met with precious little sympathetic response from Washington. Effectively, Washington has said no. So in that kind of political context, I wonder how an idea as radical as this will float and what the timescale you think is for floating it.
Okay, let me take this last batch of questions. First, of course, I would like really to thank everybody for, enduring this 2 hours of, 1 hour and a half, actually, of talk and discussion, and for asking, very good questions, which I'm sure will, help me in further work. Now, on the first question about five-year plans and investments in human capital, I must admit I have no strong view there, because essentially what my presentation today was and what my work is one part is methodological issue of essentially or methodological and calculation issue of the different concepts of inequality and their implications, and second thing is this policy. The issue of domestic policies, which of course occupies lots of time of people in the World Bank, in international so-called development community, and so forth. I really have certain views. I think that, of course, the Washington Consensus was, in some respects, reasonable. In some respects, has gone way too far and has disregarded many areas. But it was not really the main topic of my talk today. So I'm afraid I cannot say much more about this. Secondly, about the gender inequality, unfortunately, it's not included there. It's very difficult even to come to some numbers which are on per capita basis as they are here, where each individual, by the way, children and adults are treated the same. So that's another source of possible dispute there, that actually, theoretically, maybe you would actually want to use some equivalency scales. If you have like 7 people household, maybe they don't need 7 times as much money as 1 person household. But gender is not included here, and I think there will be there is like obviously need for that, but the data requirements and are just overwhelming. And whether the World Bank would take a different position, I'm not, with example of Mexico and policies of economic growth and so on, I'm not so sure. I think it's actually that certain of these policies are, it seems to me, they are not going to be changed anytime soon, because there are, of course, political reasons among other, you know, there are also political reasons why they were set in place there and why they're unlikely to be changed, which of course leads me to David's point about the political basis for something like that. Now, let me say there that I'm not totally pessimistic. And why? Because I think that the issue of a Tobin tax in one form or another is something that is on the agenda. And it is on the agenda. Even officially, countries like France and Brazil have come out in favor of that. François Bourguignon, the World Bank chief economist, has come out in favor of that. I think it's actually an idea whose momentum is gathering. I'm not sure actually momentum is a good word, but definitely an idea which I think will not go away. Now, whether it will, in what form it would come, I'm not sure. Last night I was watching Deutsche Welle, for instance, and they had an interview of people if they thought that the tax on airplane tickets would make sense for money to be transferred to poor countries. And of course the ratio was 50-50, but nevertheless, I find it actually extraordinary that there is like a one-to-one ratio of people who are in favor of it. So I really think that actually that idea has a certain momentum. Now, the key question then becomes, if one day it is done, the issue is actually what are we going to do and how that money would be distributed? Are we going to use the old mechanisms which we have used for the last half a century, or are we going to do something which I think is much more radical and which really would look as the world, as I said, this change in global thinking, as a single entity and consequently use the same rules that we use in nation states, use them at the global level. And of course with much less money, much more modest, but the rules and the ideas would be the same.
Thank you very much.